Hello, everybody, and welcome to the HTML All Things Podcast, episode number 65, More UX Considerations. I'm your host, Matt Lawrence, and I'm joined again by my co-host, Mike Horan. If you've been enjoying the podcast so far and you want to support us, there are a couple of ways that you can do that. You can view us on Apple Podcasts, what's it called, Mike? Podchaser,
yeah. I think it's a new podcasting app or platform where you can actually do reviews and interact with the hosts and stuff like that. It's kind of a new movement in podcasting. Seems like a good place to go. So if you guys can give us a review on that and get us ahead of the game, that would be awesome.
Yeah, so check us out on the Podchaser, the Apple Podcasts, or whatever podcast platform that you are listening to this on. You can also check us out on Patreon. We only have a couple of tiers right now, but that $3 tier will give you a shout out in the podcast, and we will share a link to your website in the show notes. And most notably is that we're just asking you to share us. Like, tell your friends we're here and we're ready to be listened to. And if you or your friends are ready to go a step further, you can join our Discord server. Our Discord server now has well over 200 members. So you can come in and chat about development of any kind. There's people from all walks of the industry in there getting help with stuff or just chatting about movies and generally shooting the shit, if you will. But as we always do, Mike, weekly pain point, take it away.
All right. So as most of you probably already know and are tired of hearing about, I have some travel coming up. So I spent the last week working as well as setting up my laptop for development. So that included, you know, installing all my development environments, making sure all my Git repos are up to date, getting some offline code bases, offline documentation applications installed. Just because I want to do some work on the plane. I'm going to have like a 7-hour flight and then a 4-hour flight. So I'm hoping to get a little bit of work done on there. And just a bunch of maintenance, like I was saying before, with the cleaning of the laptop, just to make sure that it's working normally and it doesn't crap out on me or overheat or something like that. Getting all that going, as well as getting a bunch of entertainment stuff, like getting my Nintendo Switch ready, getting some, you know, movies and shows and downloaded and for offline viewing on the laptop and the phone, music, podcasts, all that jazz. But that's about it for me. What about you, Matt?
So I actually just came back from some travel, but I didn't do any development at the time. I just kind of went to a vacation house / cottage for about 4 days. So I'm just getting back, and so my weekly pain point is not so much regarding this week, but regarding today onward. It's my vacation backlog. So it's got a bunch of stuff. I got some people to email, got some work to do, obviously, because I was gone. So just working through the backlog, kind of standard post-travel stuff. But in this episode, I want to talk about more UX considerations. So if you're just tuning in with us, like if this is your first episode, we had a previous episode that also had UX considerations in it. I believe it was entitled Top 3 UX Considerations or something like that. Well, this is some more UX considerations that are a bit more off the beaten path, I'd say, than the other ones. And so I kind of thought they were interesting, and I have a couple of examples that we can kind of relate to that we kind of all experience in our daily lives. So I'll jump into this first one here, which is unseen UX. So there are many applications that we use every day that go sight unseen. And oftentimes these are passive things that we just expect to produce some sort of result at random or when they're triggered or et cetera, et cetera. So I'll give an example here. So right off the top of my head, the biggest one I can think of is ABS, which is anti-lock braking system on a car. Now I just want to preface this with, I'm going to go through some generalities here. All cars are different, of course, but I'm just kind of going through my experience and a bunch of and kind of the general experience across multiple makes and models of cars. So just kind of bear with me. Don't be like, well, my car does this. Well, that's nice. Hit me up on Twitter. So anyway, with ABS, we never see it come up on a screen with its latest status. We don't have buttons on the dash so that we can control it directly. There's no app to check that it's still working. It's just there. ABS is simply a part of most cars that we expect to be there, and it just activates when it's needed on the road. Now, despite this simplicity, there's actually a level of complexity to ABS that ensures that the UX is desirable. And this will generally include a self-test whenever you start your vehicle, where the ABS dash light will come on briefly and then turns itself off. Then once it's done doing that, it just sits ready to activate in a heavy braking situation when needed. If there's any issues, that ABS light will actually come on and stay on solid, and that kind of stays on indicating to the user, hey, you need to get the system checked by a mechanic or some sort of professional because there's something up. Now, you might think, like, this is a super simple thing, like, you know, who cares? But there's a couple of takeaways from this example, including there is a lack of constant visual or audio feedback. So on your smartphones, when you're using apps, there's a constant feedback even when something's obvious. So you're watching a YouTube video, sure, that UI might disappear, but it's obvious that the video is still playing. And if the video is paused, it's obvious, but maybe that UI is still hidden, like you pause it and you wait a little bit. You can check, like just by tapping, you can check that UI and the playhead will move. There'll be obvious status indications. So on smartphones with video and other things, there's almost always constant feedback like, hey, this video is playing. Hey, this music is playing. Hey, we are, we're traveling somewhere. So there's a little vehicle icon or whatever on your GPS, a little arrow, and it's moving around. There's a constant audio or video feedback to you saying, yes, this is happening. But similarly, with the ABS system, we don't have a constant symbol that's right in our face saying, hey, the GPS is in use. Hey, the GPS is in use. Like, it doesn't, not generally does it do that. So that's kind of one off-beaten path UX thing there. Also, the fact that the system remains completely invisible until a desired result is produced automatically. So in this case, like, whatever the situation is, you know, you do a heavy braking thing and the ABS comes and takes control to try to like keep you safe and keep you from skidding out, that type of thing. That's your desired result. And you don't have to do anything. It's not like you're hitting the brake. You're like, Jesus, I'm going to skid. And then you click an ABS button. You actually just, it just happens and it just sits there ready and then happens when it needs to. So also with coming back to that visual feedback, there's only a single indicator light that calls the user to action, but it doesn't directly call the user to action. So there's no obvious status that shows up on a screen with a full description on the dash. Like it doesn't say, hey, there's something wrong with sensor 2 and ABS. It doesn't say that. It's just ABS. Like it just literally typically an amber ABS light. It's just solid. That's it. The indicator lamp itself doesn't actually use any language or verbiage found on call to action buttons in things such as apps or to other things that tell the user what's going on. So in an app, you might click the sync button. You know, that's a verb, sync. So you're like, oh, if I click this button, like the data will sync or whatever. That doesn't happen here. It literally just says ABS amber. That's it. That's all it says. It doesn't even say amber. It's just, it is the color amber. So one second. Let's replace it. Okay. So either the person, the user needs to actually know, what the issue is, or they need to know enough to consult the vehicle's user manual. And this kind of leads into my next point here, is that unseen UX, so situations like this, are often accompanied by norms or industry standards that are commonly unwritten rules. Things like knowing that lights on your dash, even without those call to actions like sync or like help or something like that, should prompt the user to check their manual or call their mechanic. That's just something that people need to kind of know. And nowhere from the sale of your vehicle to driving the vehicle for prolonged periods are the norms for maintenance or the severity of certain warning lights expressed. There's some that are more serious, like service, that's a bit more like, oh Jesus, there's like usually a wrench icon and you kind of know, but like there's like a check engine light and sometimes it doesn't even say the word check, it's just an engine, so you're just like, well, it's yellow, is that real bad, is it bad, do I drive, do I not? Like it's unseen, no one really talks to you about it. You would have to ask a professional, and you need to know to ask that professional as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's the unseen part of UX is kind of tough to, again, see, I guess, or picture how it will work with the maybe kind of like your planning of web development, your planning of a website. Like, how would you use this unseen UX strategy like an ABS in terms of when you're planning a site? Like, is it more on the administrative side? So I could see it working like if there's a CMS and you have a bunch of people entering information into a CMS, an unseen UX thing could be that it will autocorrect your email if you enter, you know, if you format it incorrectly. It'll autocorrect a URL if you format it incorrectly, stuff like that. Is that the sort of unseen UX that we can implement into a web design? And is there one for the more consumer-facing side that you can think of?
Well, for the web development side, I can definitely attest to more of the back end stuff, like more setting stuff up. So for sure, like let's say, for example, you have some sort of cloud backup of what the user is doing, and they're typing into a rich text box, so they're blogging away. One of the things that's sort of sometimes sight unseen, but sometimes is actually seen as well, is that sometimes the actual data being typed in there will be saved at a fixed interval, let's say, to some sort of cloud backup, mm-hmm. and they won't always see it. Sometimes there is an indicator, but that's one thing that could easily be like, you know, so if the, you know, let's say it's backing up, the user doesn't know, and then the web page crashes, then you like come, then you log back in and you're like, shit, I probably lost all that like blog writing. But then you're like, oh no, I only lost like, you know, a couple lines or whatever, because it was saving every 2 minutes, but you didn't know. That's like kind of like a prime example, I'd say. A more consumer facing one, I'm trying to think, like what do you mean by more consumer facing? Like, so, you think that the consumer interacts with it, or like?
So I think you brought up the perfect one to kind of lead to the consumer one. So something like a cart in it for a consumer. So someone that's putting something in a cart, they leave the site by accident or their computer crashes. If they come back to the site and the cart is still saved, that's an unseen UX thing. So I think that's the perfect kind of example of something that you would put into a site that's unseen by the user until they actually need it. Like, so they don't notice it until, you know, it's too late or it's an emergency or whatever. I mean, obviously crashing a website's usually not an emergency in the sense that ABS braking is, but it's something that you can kind of take into account when you're looking at planning, in the planning stages of your site. So go through all the different kind of UX patterns that you're going to be using and use the ones that are important for the people, and then don't. Another good thing with unseen UX is it doesn't throw anything at the user that they don't need to know. Like, you don't need to, every time you save something to the cart, you don't need to pop up a little pop-up saying, hey, we've saved it to the cart, don't worry, it's actually saved to the local storage, so you don't have to worry about it. Like, you don't have to tell the user, or you don't have to hold the user's hand in that sense. It'll just work for the user when they need it. It's something that is complementary rather than, you know, shown and explained to the user. Those are the kinds of trade-offs that you have to make when you're talking about UX.
That's a really interesting point, because you don't like it sometimes is something that you don't want to annoy the user. Like, okay, so you, like, my car has like a manual. Actually, I don't think my car has ABS, by the way. I'm pretty sure does not have ABS. Anyway,
a little dangerous.
No, like, I don't, like, not due to it, like, breaking. I don't think it came equipped with ABS.
Yeah, anyway, I understand, yeah.
But, like, on your car, you have, like, a digital dash, right? Like, a digital dashboard. Yes. It would be, like, super easy for them to constantly, like, every 5 minutes be like, ABS is working fine, like, literally written out that way. That'd be annoying as hell.
Yep.
Like, so you're kind of, you have that thing where you just, the user just kind of expects it. And it needs to be invisible enough, I'd say, in most cases where, like, for example, I'm not constantly, like, looking at the panels in my car that have the word airbag, like, etched into them. I'm not constantly being like, ooh, there's an airbag here. Like, I'm not, like, every couple minutes, ooh, there's an airbag here. Like, it's just a safety mechanism that, like, better freaking work in an accident. And that's kind of it. It's one of those things. And it's sort of something that you don't, well, number one, you don't want to attract the user's attention too much unless it's needed. So the call to action in this case is the fact that, in the ABS example, that there's an amber light. So, like, hopefully the person has enough knowledge or has enough sense to be like, this wasn't on before, like, I used to turn on briefly or whatever. I need to either check my manual or I need to call a mechanic, like, right away. But now I'm trying to get to the next point here. So, like, you don't want to attract the user's attention unless it's needed. You don't want to make them fidget with it, if that makes sense. Like, you know, ABS is, like, under the car or wherever the hell it is, so they can't exactly fiddle with it. But, like, the airbag, you don't want them constantly, like, poking at it or, like, beating on it or something like that. You're like, you know what I mean? Like, you know how people will, like, fidget and fumble with things? You want it just to sort of really, like, blend into the vehicle in terms of UX, because you're just like, this person needs to be safe in an accident. They don't need to know how the airbag works. They don't need to click an airbag button in most cases. They don't need to do anything. They just need to be, like, in the car, and that's it. Because I know that some cars have that passenger airbag thing, where it detects if a passenger's there or something. My car does not have that, so I don't know how that works. But, like, what I mean is, like, you're not clicking a button to turn on, like, the driver's side airbag, for example, every time you go into the car. You're not going into the car and clicking on in your car, I assume, Mike.
I'm not. And the passenger is also not doing that. The passenger airbag thing is where it works by weight. So it's a self-detection and self-preventing and unseen kind of thing. It is a little bit seen because there is an indicator if it's on or off.
Right.
Or there's an indicator if it's off. It'll actually be unseen if it's working properly, if that makes sense. Or if it's on and everything's okay, the light will go off, which is, you know, counterintuitive. But what it does is it, like, if you, let's say you're not supposed to. You put a baby up there. It's not enough weight.
Because an airbag would like kill an infant.
Correct. Yeah. If you had a physical button, then you could take the risk on the car itself, right? Like, or the user of the car, which you don't want to do, because the users are typically not knowledgeable and they don't know what the heck's going on. So they'll be like, "Oh, my kid's in the front seat. I didn't read any rule book, so it's a baby. I need to put the airbag on," not knowing that obviously the airbag will come and explode and destroy the baby. But that kind of stuff is prevented by just having a sensor there that detects weight and you're good to go. And again, that's very indicative of how you would, you know, plan out in a website. You would also plan out something that's, if it's unseen, the user doesn't have to interact with it. Make sure that that it's kind of bulletproof in a sense, where the user will just only notice it if it's working, essentially.
Yes.
And hopefully, even when it's working, they won't notice it too much either. That's another thing with unseen UX, in my opinion, is like, it's something that prevents the user from complaining in the future. And you'll never know if it's working properly because they won't tell you that it's a great feature or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Like, I mean, like, yeah, the call to actions, essentially, like, to kind of sum that up with more UX speak, it's like the call to actions need to be only when it's really needed, like when there's an issue with the ABS, like we've already said, and not like all the time. Like, you're saying that the light, you know, turns off and on, like it goes off and on depending on if there's a person in there, like someone weighs enough or whatever. But it's not like constantly flashing. It's not causing a dinger in the car to go off, like ding, there's a person here, ding, like that's annoying, right? And so like that's one of those unseen things. And that's a really good point too, is that this is something that you don't want people to mess with, but you always want them to have, which would be safety devices, ABS, airbag, other things like that. That's a really good way to put it. The same thing would go if you take websites. The cloud save is a really good one, obviously, for stuff like that. Also, like, excuse me, this is more manual, but like you might not report to a user, like as a web admin, as like a site admin, you might not report to a user, but you might be doing, you know, monthly backups or something like that. So like, even though like someone's doing it, like that's unseen UX, like they don't realize that until the time comes when, holy crap, like we updated this plugin and WordPress is completely broken or something. What do we do? And it's like, well, I have a backup from last month. And then it's like, wow, we only going to lose 2 blog posts out of 500 or something. You know, that's way better. And so they'll never complain about you taking backups like that. That's sort of another piece of unseen UX, if you will. So the next one actually is going to be forgotten UX. So this one's a little bit more unique. This one has a little bit more feedback and a couple of different stages, if you will. So I'm going to go through here and then we can have a discussion. So there are a couple of UX situations that are designed so that beginners can look for feedback and the veteran can completely forget what's going on. And I'll get into that in a second. So the biggest example that I can think of would be unlocking your phone with your face. So if we take the UX situation of my Note 10 Plus, what I've done here is I've set up Face Unlock to look for my face whenever the lock screen comes up. And if it detects my face, the phone will unlock. I've also permitted the face unlock to brighten the screen if it's having trouble seeing me in order to illuminate my face better. Third point here is that my typical phone use case is picking up the phone, double tapping on the screen, and having the face unlock do its job so I can start using my phone. And if it fails, I can either type in my PIN or use the on-screen fingerprint reader as alternatives. So here's where this sort of experience differs between the veteran and the beginner. So here's the beginner steps here, or the experience for the beginner. Having freshly set up Face Unlock, the beginner will generally lock their phone and then look for feedback from the device indicating what's going on. So for the Note 10 Plus, this is presented via an animation, and it's like a little illumination around the ring of the front camera cutout. And it's followed immediately by the phone either unlocking, so you don't need to do anything, and the animation will stop immediately. Alternatively, if it doesn't work, you can have a status message appearing right below the camera cutout, and it'll say what's wrong. Like, oh, you know, no face detected, blah, 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 etc., etc. Now, the beginner may look for these particular pieces of visual feedback for the first few unlocks, or even for the first few days when turning on the face unlock. You know, they're trying to make sure, hey, am I actually unlocking it with my face? Like, I want to be secure. I don't want, you know, Jim to be able to unlock my phone. What's going on here? So they might be a little bit more paranoid or just want to understand how it's working. And those visual feedbacks help with that. However, now this is for the veteran. For the veteran user of this, despite these pieces of visual feedback still showing up every single time, every single time, like, the lock screen comes up in this case, the veteran can forget all about them and often will not even look at the front-facing camera area where these status messages are. Instead, this UX situation has evolved to the user trusting in the feature and already focusing on the part of the screen they're about to use when the phone is unlocked. So, like, let's hypothetically say your phone dialer is in your bottom left. The guy who is used to this, the veteran that's used to using this feature, will like double tap on the screen to unlock and will already be looking in the bottom left to aim his fingers so he can tap on the phone dialer because he needs to make a phone call. That's something like that. However, this isn't where this UX situation ends. Because face unlock isn't super reliable, and this isn't necessarily due to face unlock, it's due to the fact that you might be wearing glasses, you might look different that day if you have like a beard or something, or whatever, or it's too dark. This visual feedback now actually turns into a very useful troubleshooting tool. And without skipping a beat, a veteran user will determine, hey, face unlock did indeed fail, and now I need to use a fingerprint or a PIN that needs to be entered. Now, the importance of feedback on the screen goes beyond the beginner and veteran needs as well. It's also used by technicians when troubleshooting issues. So every feature or button on a screen, excuse me about my microphone, on the screen could be a unique identifier required to get to the bottom of an issue in troubleshooting. It also instills confidence that face unlock, in this case, is still doing its job and hasn't simply crashed or been turned off accidentally. So one of the things that we've all said when troubleshooting an issue, if you're a person that likes to troubleshoot things yourself, is why the hell wasn't there an error message? Why the hell wasn't there a status message for this? Like, why wasn't I informed by the device that, hey, this failed? Or in this case, it'd be like, maybe, I don't know, you did some sort of big update to your phone and your face unlock just turned off. Like, it was a glitch when you did the update, as we've all had. Face unlock just turned off. Like, if you think that face unlock is still working and it's not working, you might actually send that phone in for physical repair, thinking that the face unlock is broken. But in reality, it's something as simple as, oh, well, it's no visual feedback, what the heck's going on? You'll explore the settings and determine, hey, face unlock is off, right? So it's important to, like, and I'll like, summarize this. It's important to have these visual cues whenever you think a user may have to interact with it at some point. So, for example, with the face unlock, it wasn't on out of the box. I had to go turn that on, set it up. Now I got to see how it works. Now I also have a troubleshooting tool there as well. But if it's something that the user will never touch, this is where normally error statuses are left to logs and that type of thing that technicians will use with root access or whatever to actually view that. And so you're keeping the user away from something that maybe is too advanced for them to like mess around with. But with face unlock, they can toggle the switch in the settings off and on a million times. Like, who cares whether you want face unlock or not? So an interesting like sort of thing as well, like with the visual feedback. So the visual feedback needs to not be right in your face, but it needs to be like usable, if you will. So just like how if you have like a critical error on your computer, generally speaking, it will focus on it. So like maybe you're typing away in something and the error message pops up. A lot of the time it'll pop up right in the center of your screen and it will like your computer will focus on it. So it'll take your cursor away from what you're writing and you'll like have to click OK when it's a critical error. But when it's not that critical of an error, those errors, like if you're like a Windows tech or anything, you know that when you go into Event Viewer on your computer, and this is Windows, so remember that there are thousands of errors and warnings and other crap that all gets logged in there, all at varying severity, but it wasn't severe enough to interrupt the UX of the person. So that's like forgotten. That's forgotten and oftentimes completely unseen by the user, the unforgotten or the unseen and the forgotten kind of go in tandem here because they never see, oh, that Windows had trouble mounting some sort of drive when in reality that drive was unplugged by the user and like he's done with it anyway. So Windows just stopped using that drive, obviously, because the user unplugged it. And they don't see that Windows was freaking out. There's not like a thing that pops up and says, please replug in that drive. What's going on? Please replug in that drive. What's going on? That doesn't exist. And that would just be straight up annoying.
That's interesting. Just because it probably requires quite a bit of experience and knowledge on the subject to be able to determine what should be forgotten and what shouldn't, right? Like how would you determine what is a critical error and what isn't? I guess a critical error will have to be something that actually breaks the use of whatever you're using. So if it's a critical error for Windows, it would have to be something that, you know, actually causes an application to shut down actually causes the computer to shut down, something like that. Like, that's, those are the kind of criteria. A blue screen is a critical error, so that does indicate that. But you get some, like you said, sometimes you get those critical errors right at the front. I get them from my email client sometimes, saying like it failed to connect to a database. But I also get them, and my email client is kind of hasn't perfected this. My email client is definitely in the worst case for this, where it'll pop up with these warnings almost daily saying that database integrity has been lost, and it'll pop up just like an actual like critical pop up, even though everything's still working perfectly in the background. So I'm assuming like at some point the data integrity got lost, or like a connection to the database got lost, and then it reestablished and everything was fine, but it doesn't just make the dialogue disappear. So that was a bad implementation of this, right? Like that would be like, I don't know, like, you know, like you were saying, a mounted drive that gets unplugged by you, and then every 5 minutes it'll keep popping up saying, I'm trying to, you know, remount to this drive. It's a tough line to balance, because like you said, if you don't put something on the screen, so something where the user indicates that something's wrong, like maybe it's a phone issue, like maybe they'll think it's a phone issue, like with the face unlock, like you were saying, maybe the fingerprint unlock is also another good example, because that is a hardware thing. Like if you're pressing the finger and it fails a couple times, you could think that it might be the phone sensor. But a lot of the times, manufacturers will actually, like, if it fails a couple times, they'll put an indicator on the screen saying, maybe you have a dirty finger. Maybe you, like, just try again, you know, like they'll tell you the next steps that you should take before you determine that it is a hardware issue, because manufacturers don't want people sending back phones for, you know, stupid things like that.
Definitely.
If they get water on their hands, sometimes the fingerprint sensors don't work, stuff. Well, different kinds of situations. Now, having said that, I'm trying to bring this back into like a web conversation as well. Like what's one of these examples on a website? Like, I guess actually one is, all the, like if you open up your console log on almost any site you go on, you're going to get a bunch of console errors on there. Now those errors aren't, and they're errors, but usually they don't affect UX and a person's ability to use the site. It's just something like some communication with the server failed. Maybe you have an ad blocker, so you're blocking a bunch of ads and it's telling you that there's some, you know, again, communication with the ad server failed, stuff like that. If a website were to take it seriously and be like, any console error, we need to display it to the user, that would be extremely annoying. Sometimes though, maybe there is an error that they have to display, like a database, like someone's trying to send a form request, or someone's trying to send a login request, and that is a database connection error or something like that, then you need to display it. So again, you need to make those distinctions, those decisions beforehand, before you start kind of coding the site, before you start putting the infrastructure in place. What is considered a kind of critical error, I guess, and what would be considered a more, you know, forgotten thing that you don't have to pop into the face of your user every time something happens?
That's a really good point. Like, I think that a good like rule of thumb, or maybe not a rule of thumb, but a common use case, I would say, is a delay of some sort or an auto retry. So it would be something like, oh, this hard drive, you know, failed to mount. So like the system will actually try a few times before, you know, doing the error. Same with like a lot of cloud things, like it'll maybe like try to save a few times, or it'll say, like sometimes it'll be visual feedback where it'll say, hey, like, you know, save failed, we'll like, you know, we'll try to save again. And then like, you know, if it works, then that's it. You don't really have to worry about it. That's sort of like forgotten UX, where the guy who's troubleshooting it, like the IT tech or whatever, might like go and look for that type of thing and be like, oh, why is it failing every third one? But to the user, it's not super critical because it's still saving, let's say, their blog post on the third one or something like that. That's sort of a key one, I would say. There's also like things that I would say that the user can't correct. So for example, if we downloaded, we set up a Google Maps API for a website, we go to embed a site, we go to embed a Google Map into a site, we have our API key, and like I copy it wrong or something like that, and it just has a space on the end. And the CMS, let's say, always chopped that space off, no problem, it worked for a long time. But then all of a sudden, CMS updates, and all of a sudden that space is acknowledged, and then Google's like map server is like, nope, that's not the API key, you know, it's one key too long or whatever. The user can't fix that. You know, it has to be a tech, it has to be a web admin, it has to be someone that's going to go in there and like know how to fix it. So the person that's looking for the directions is incapable of fixing the problem. And as a result, you have one of two options, really. You have one where you just don't throw an error, or you throw one like, hey, maps is unavailable right now. Or if you expect that to possibly happen, like sometimes you'll have like a failure case where you're like, oh, I mean, this doesn't happen. But like, let's say hypothetically that Google Maps goes down all the time, hypothetically. We might be like, well, if it goes down all the time, what I want is like my address, my straight up address to show up so that somebody could at least see that. So you might, in terms of the UI, have the Google Map and then actually render in plain text the address behind the Google Map. And when the Google Map fails to render, have a case there where you kill the Google Map and you keep the text. So in other words, what you're providing is a lesser UX, yes, because the person can't see a map, nor can they just click directions or send a phone or whatever other options there are with Google Maps. However, it's better for them because they're not seeing something that's literally broken. So like you can use like a lesser UX sometimes in order to save the user from seeing something that's totally broken. But the console log, like you said, would still throw an error. And that's because the people who are diving in regardless need to see what it was. Was it a database error? Was it an API key refused? Like, what's wrong with it? They need to see what's going on. And so it's almost like hiding errors from people that don't need to see it or don't often need to see it. But I will say that companies will overstep, and this is like a difficult thing to do, overstep or understep. Sometimes they give out too many errors, like your mail app. Maybe that's too many mm-hmm. errors. Like, I don't know exactly what's going on with your database, but like, let's say it's actually fine, but it's getting an error here and there. That's too many errors, in my opinion. How, because you're still using the app. However, in the case of like something that may go wrong. So I'll give a real world example. So this weekend, I went to go take a picture of my phone and it just like opened my camera app and it was just black. So I thought the sensor was broken. I was like, well, okay, there goes the camera. That's good. But then I realized like, I actually can't take a picture. I can't swap the camera around. Like, there's no icons. So I go into, because I'm more tech savvy than like, you know, most people. So like I go into the processes, I go into the camera app, I do a force stop and I open it up again. And I realize that actually more icons are gone. So I'm like, shit, there's something like one of the connections to this, like the gallery or the Bixby vision or something is down. Like something's not right. Restart the phone and that's fine. But realistically speaking, because I had opened the camera app so many times and it was clearly having problems, in my opinion, Samsung should have some sort of option there that says like, hey, like Bixby Services is down, or I don't know if it was Bixby. I don't know what it was. But like hypothetically, if it was Bixby Services, why don't we just say like, hey, Bixby Services is actually having trouble connecting. Can you do this thing? Because yeah, the UX, like right away, is some people would just open it once, be like, oh, this is broken, and restart. So you don't really need to do an error. But if the person is clearly like stuck, like I, like my brain, let's say, if I'm not tech savvy, is stuck in a loop where I'm like, open camera, what the hell? Open camera, what the hell? Open camera, come on, open camera. Some people are not tech savvy enough to know to restart, or they might start to panic or something, right? Because they're like, shit, I want to take this picture really fast, because it's an instant thing that they need to do. And so they need to know, like the phone should say, please restart, or do whatever. Funny enough, the phone does say, please restart, if it keeps not detecting a face. Because it thinks like, hey, it literally says, if your phone keeps doing this, please restart it. But in reality, it's normally because I'm unlocking it from a desk and my face isn't in range. But like, you know, no problem. But at least there's some sort of feedback there. So that I understand that was like a fluke. Like I've never had that happen before on any of my phones. So like, whatever. It's probably just some stupid service thing. But that's still a UX thing where I think any app, if the person's getting stuck in a loop or they constantly keep opening and closing it, that's generally a safe thing to say like, hey, there's something wrong here. Run like an error check and just be like, hey, we recommend rebooting your phone. Even that, right? Maybe they don't even want to tell me it's Bixby service or the gallery's down or something. Just, hey, just please reboot your phone. And that would be better, because then I wouldn't have to like exit out the app, click and hold the button, then click restart. It's like, nope, just click restart right here. It showed it up for me. You know, it's right here. So.
Mm-hmm. So one question I have for you is with the veteran thought. So someone that's been using a feature for a very long time, when do you think is a good idea to kind of take away the training wheels on certain things? So let's say, let's take Face Unlock for an, as an example. You've been using it for, you know, a month or two. The device registers that you know how to use it. Everything's good. Do you think it's okay for the device to then start, you know, doing stuff a little bit differently, where it's going to hide a few visual indicators, where it will kind of detect that you're picking it up, and it knows, like, it follows your habits enough where it'll skip steps because it knows that you've already done this enough times? Does that make sense? Like, is there a point where that makes sense to do? Or do you think that because of the situation where you can get the forgotten UX issue where something could go wrong and then you could forget how to fix it, that that should never happen and there should always be visual indicators for stuff like this?
Well, that's actually interesting, because I would say there's a couple ways you could think of this. So in this case, the visual indicators are not extremely obvious, but they're obvious enough to like be seen, especially if you're new to it. I would say that they also mask it in an interesting animation. So it's not just something that says, like, it's not like a really generic developer message saying face unlock is attempting, face unlock has failed. It's like a little, like I said, it's like a little ring, like kind of being drawn around the camera. So that's one way to kind of get around it. And in that case, because it just kind of looks cool and it's just like a thing the phone does, and it almost adds like a layer of polish, just like how animations do when you like swipe left and right on home screens and stuff. With that being said, I would say that that type of stuff doesn't need to be hidden. However, there is an argument to be had regarding whether or not you should have UX evolve automatically without telling the user. I'm actually still trying to grasp this concept, not the fact that I don't understand it, but I don't know if I like the idea of the phone automatically being like, oh, they understand how to use Face Unlock, I'm going to automatically toggle on pickup detection. Because what you might end up doing is you might interrupt the user's muscle memory, and you might almost set them back to beginner status. Like, hey, what the heck's going on here? Like, why is this like suddenly just like working now? I don't have to double tap. Why am I not double tapping? And for some users that don't care, like, and that's a lot. For some users that don't care, they're like, oh, that's convenient. That was an update or something, right? They think it's convenient. But for some people that are a bit more, I would say orderly, because that's the people I notice it in, but I haven't done like a study. But I would say for the people that like maybe pay attention more, I'd be like, whoa, what the hell is this thing doing? And I would immediately go into the settings and be like, is there something toggled on here? Like, I don't want this on unless I tell it to, or I want to at least read the description of the feature. I understand that like machine learning and that type of thing, but like machine learning could also, you know, have a prompt that shows up and says, hey, we suggest you turn on pickup detection. Like, you could have a prompt, but then you got to remember that you don't want that to be like an error message. So like, when do you prompt that on? Like, this, you know what I mean? It sounds so simple, right? Like, it's not really rocket science, but it's like use case science, I guess. It's like, you really need to think about this type of stuff. Like, I'll give an example. I was talking to you about this the other day. And this is really simple. I went to an older theater, a couple weeks ago or a week ago, something like that. And it had recently redone this year, which is fine. And the guy who like redid the bathroom, specifically the sink area, okay, must have honestly like just gone through the motions of like what we need. So it's like, okay, we may have a lot of people, so we need two sinks. Okay, there's two checks. We got to have the soap dispenser. That's a check. And we got to have a dryer for your hands. That's a check. Now, I stood on the left sink. My friend stood on the right sink washing her hands. The soap dispenser was only to his right. So in order to get to it, I have to reach in front of him and like past him to hit the soap dispenser. If he wants to use... Oh, there was also a paper towel dispenser. If he wants to use paper towel after washing his hands, his UX is fine. The soap dispenser is right there. He hits it, uses the thing, and it's right to his right. That's fine. He wants to use the hand dryer. It's behind me. It's to my left on a wall because like the room ends. So it's like a perpendicular wall. And it's like, what? Like, who the hell? Like, it's not that big of a deal, right? But it's immediately, I was like, whoa, this is set out weird. And I almost, like, if you think about it, especially if I was in a hurry, muscle memory in a washroom is you put your hands in the thing and then you'd be like, hit the soap dispenser, right? I almost, like, rudely just, like, cut in front of him. And I'd, like, double take, like, oh, shit, like, why the hell is this so far away? So that, the reason why I mention that is that sort of interruption is what I'm mentioning. Is if you interrupt the user's like muscle memory, you're going to make them think like, I didn't realize the dryer was even behind me until I like started looking. It's like, whoa, this is laid out weird. So it's like to get into the mind of those that are doing use case, right?
One big point that I want to point out is like, notice how you're only remembering, or for the most part, you vividly remember bad UX.
Yeah.
So you vividly, like, and that leaves a bad taste in your mouth. It's not a huge deal, like you're saying, but it is something that you remember and is an impression that you have and that you've stated multiple times, et cetera, et cetera. In web design or in web development, it's the same story. Like, if someone comes to your site and there is one of these, like, things that just keep popping up to him or something like that, they're going to remember that. And that might be a bad impression that they're going to carry with them for a very long time.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
That they might tell other people about and they will try to avoid your site. So that's why this is an important conversation. That's why you should be thinking about this as you're designing, as you're developing. You should be thinking about making sure that the user is not particularly remembering, at least not the bad things. Like, there are cases where the user remembered the good things, but it's less likely.
Yes. 100%.
And it's nothing to... Yeah, and it's less to do with how, like, you design or whatever. Like, you're still doing a good job. The less that they remember, in my opinion, the better job that you're doing. Because, again, as we're people, we tend to remember the bad way more than the adequate or the good. Now, if it's excellent, we'll remember that as well. But those kinds of situations are far and few between. Like, it's really tough to design something that will give pleasure to the person as they're using it. Like, if they're filling out a form and they're getting pleasure from filling out that form on the site, then you've done something extremely well. And it's a very difficult task. I'm sure it's doable, but it's something, it's not something – you're not going to spend, a year designing a form to make somebody have a euphoric reaction. Like, it's just not realistic.
Correct.
You're going to spend an adequate amount of time, maybe a couple days, designing a form to make sure that the user's not yelling swear words at the wall and remembering and cursing your name to all of his friends. That's the goal, I think, especially in some more utilitarian tasks, at least in a site.
Yeah, like a key thing would be, like, when you put extra thought into something like that, a key thing would be, like, for example, with the form, when you hit the tab key, does it go to the next thing or does it accidentally skip? Does it go down for some reason to the submit button and focus, and then the person panics, hits enter, just because the muscle memory is when I'm on submit, I hit enter. Now they sent a half-baked email in a form. Like, muscle memory and interacting with that and interacting with, and we've talked about this, and we'll get to the web news in a few minutes here, but, like, interacting with how the user perceives things based on norms, based on how your competitors are doing it, which are often established norms, like the other UX considerations, they're freaking big, man. Like, and one final note, you have to know your audience as well. Like, for example, I'm using Audacity to record right now. If you're using a basic recording app on your phone, it is not Audacity, straight up. It's not Audacity. Like, I'm using Audacity to record and I use it to edit. In Audacity right now, I look at the bottom, it's got the project rate in hertz, it's got the snap to, it's got the audio position, it's got the start to the end of the selection, it's got how much disk space is remaining in hours, which is, like, a big thing. It's telling me that I'm currently recording, but on an app, for the most part, you're going to have, like, a timestamp, and you're going to press record, and it's going to tell you if you're recording or not, and it's going to tell you how long you've been recording. That's the use case for an app. Why? Because it's different situations, and I would even use it. The situations are, I'm in a quick thing, even with Zoom recorders. Like, Zoom recorders are more professional, like, recorders for on the go. They have a lot of feedback, but a lot of the time, if they're set up properly, are as easy as, oh, I need to talk to this person. Like, let's say I'm interviewing Mike in public. Point it in front of him, or, like, point it depending on what the mic say, and I just click record, and that's it. It's just like, it's like a point and shoot camera almost in this case. But now that I'm sitting down, it's a different environment. I'm sitting down, I got my boom arm, my proper microphone, I got my webcam, all my programs. I'm ready to do a serious recording that has no compromise of travel. Mike is going to have to switch microphones when he records one episode while he's gone, which is like fine. However, that microphone will be worse than the one he's using now, and his program will be the same because he's sitting down at a computer, but if he connected that microphone somehow to his phone, he wouldn't want all that crap on the phone. He would want, is it recording? Yeah. Is it, like, is it going to save? Is it, like, you know, what's it doing? Is it auto-saving? Is it doing this? Is it doing that? He just wants basic statuses. He just wants to make sure it's recording, and that's it. He doesn't need all this extra crap as well. So, but with that, before I talk too much, I'm going to pass it on to Mike for the web news.
Yeah, let's do it. I think that was a good UX conversation, though, and I think we'll have more of these. It'll be kind of like a little recurring series that we do where we think of UX and talk about it back and forth in a conversation style setting.
Definitely.
So stay tuned for that. So this week's web news, cross-play, cross-use. So staying in like kind of popular media right now, Sony announced recently that they will be supporting cross-play across a lot of their titles. I think it's like 84 games or something. Like there's a lot of games that are supporting cross-play at this point, right off the bat in the beta. And what that means for the people that that don't play games or whatever is that they will allow other platforms to play with the players from their platform. So that means that PS4 gamers will now be able to play with Xbox One gamers, PC gamers, maybe even Switch gamers in very limited circumstances, stuff like that. So there will be essentially a larger user base of gamers, and they'll all be able to play with each other. Which is an interesting thought, because before like this was announced, there were a couple games, I know Fortnite being one of them, that allowed this to happen. And it was kind of a really cool experience. Like one time I got into the Fortnite fad a little bit, and I played it with some friends, and I was playing on the PC. My friend was playing on the PS4. I think I had another friend playing on their phone, and we were all in the same lobby kind of playing together.
Yep.
On all these different platforms. And it was really, it was a really cool experience. Like I've never experienced that before. It's such a weird little thing to think about, that it would have changed the way the game played, but it did, because I don't know, it just felt more cohesive. It felt like stuff. I don't know.
It felt normal.
It felt normal. Yeah, exactly. It felt like I could do what I wanted to do. Like I didn't have to be in these locked gardens that, like, usually if I was on PS4, no one was online or something like that, and I would have to switch the computer and then everyone would go to PS4. It was just it's an annoying process. Now it doesn't matter. Like you can just choose a platform that you like, maybe that has the good exclusive games that you like, and just stick to that platform instead of wasting a bunch of money and generating waste with your, like, with a bunch of stuff in your house with, like, you know, a PS4, an Xbox One, a Switch. If you have like 15 different, you know, gaming devices, because usually how people buy gaming devices or gaming consoles is because their friends have bought it. So, for instance, like 8 years ago when Xbox 360 was around, I didn't really like Xbox, but all my friends were playing Halo and all my friends were playing NHL and they were all on Xbox. So I was like, well, now I have a PS3, but no one's playing on that. I have to buy an Xbox. I begrudgingly bought that Xbox because of that situation. I won't have to do that theoretically now, because I could just play with them, because the games other than Halo, yes, that's an exclusive. So if I wanted to play that, I'd have to buy it. But NHL, I would be able to play with them if crossplay is supported. I would be able to play with them on Xbox or PC or whatever. So it's a cool concept. With that being said, if we look at it back from the game, from the web development industry, we've kind of had cross use for a very long time. And cross use in this kind of terms would be being able to use like a website on multiple different operating systems and multiple different browsers. So you can, you know, you can open up Google in a Edge browser. That, in my opinion, is cross use. They could easily turn that off, or somehow turn that off, and then it would be a much more fragmented society where we'd have to, you know, open up Bing, which no one would ever do, but we would have to open up Bing or Edge to open up all the Microsoft services. Like imagine if Office 365 only worked on Edge, and then if OneDrive if Google Drive only worked on Chrome. Like that does not happen at this point. There are a few niche applications, like really small ones, usually internal company apps that are only built for one device, like one browser, but that's because there's a little cross compatibility issues in different browsers, especially older ones.
Older web apps.
We all know
that,
exactly, for web apps. We all know that the issues with Internet Explorer and stuff like that. So people decided, hey, to save some money, we'll build only for Chrome or only for Internet Explorer and not worry about the other ones. But usually those are only internal web apps. For larger websites, they are very much cross use, cross platform, cross everything. But with cross development, that's a different story. So yes, we are able to develop web applications on all different devices. So you can develop, you know, a web application on a Mac, on a PC, on a Windows computer, on a Linux computer. It doesn't matter. But there's limitations for debugging. So you can't debug Safari problems in a Windows machine or a Linux machine. You can't debug iOS applications, or you can't develop iOS applications on a Windows machine. So there are some very direct lines that companies are very much trying to uphold. Like, they don't want that to happen. Now, I say companies, but really there's only one. And I don't mean to, again, attack them personally, but if I'm going to push an agenda, I want there to be cross-use or cross-platform in everything that I do. Because it just makes it makes life easier. It makes choice better. Because again, I mentioned this many times before, but what I would want to do is I want to be able to choose any laptop that I want to use. I don't care if it's a Dell, I don't care. Maybe it is a Mac, but I want to be able to choose whatever laptop I want to use, be able to travel with it and use and do everything that I need on it. At this point, I can't. Because I need to do a lot of development for iOS, and I need to do a lot of development for Safari to test with Safari. So I only have one choice, and everyone knows it's a Mac. So I have to choose a MacBook Pro or whatever. So I don't have a choice, and I like having choice. That's one of the big things for me. There's some positives and negatives, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But with that, there's also another thing that's happening. So not to throw a bunch of stuff at you, but there's also the rise in cloud computing. So stuff like PS Now, Google Stadia, and Netflix, which like could be considered a cloud computing platform because it does a lot of rendering on its side, right? It does a lot of the storage of the device, like of the information, does a lot of the storage of the actual media, and it does a lot of the compiling. Like, it does a lot of work for you where it just allows you to play on any single device. It's a central storage platform. With the nature of these new platforms, it brings in cross compatibility and it kind of forces it on everyone else. So the Netflix platform makes everyone have to develop a Netflix app. So like my LG WebOS TV has a Netflix app. Like, I'm sure there's a bunch of different smart, more niche smart TVs that have a Netflix app. And it's kind of forced on them because there's such a big user base in Netflix. And this is now happening with a bunch of other things like Stadia is going to be developing, you know, everyone's going to be developing Stadia apps and stuff like that. So it's an interesting place that we're living in. Like, it's an interesting movement that we're going towards, this cross platform and cross everything, because it could lead to some really cool things. So I want to know what your thoughts are on this, Matt. What's your thoughts on the cross play being enabled on gaming consoles? Cause I know you have a lot of gaming consoles already. So do you care? Like, was it bothering you at all at some point? Is there anything in web development that you think isn't cross use? Like, well, actually, no, I don't know if you mentioned anything, but is there anything that you can think of? And how will this cloud computing affect the cross compatibility? Like, how will it keep pushing it?
Well, to answer your first question about my console stuff. So, like, I'm a pretty big gamer. Like, I have like a gaming computer. I have an Xbox One. I have a PS4. I have a Switch. And then like the previous gen was the same thing. I had a Wii U, a 360, a PS3, and a Wii. Like, I have it all. I have a 3DS. I have a Vita. The whole like kit and caboodle. Like, this is like, people say like, that's a lot of money. Yeah, well, like, some people go boating, I do games, and so like, this is sort of my thing. However, with this being said, moving forward, because of these changes, like these going toward more toward the services with PlayStation Now, or even something like Xbox Game Pass, where you're not streaming the games, you're paying a subscription, you get like a Netflix like library, but you just download them and use it with local computing. It's not computed, you know, in the cloud and then brought down to you by streaming. So to answer your question, yes, this has actually been annoying, because back in the day, back in the 360 days, everybody had a 360 in my high school. Like, if we play with them, it was 360. So obviously, when the next generation comes around, any gamer knows that when you go to the next generation, like in terms of consoles, like, you lose a couple people. Some people are like, I'm not buying this, period. Like, I'm done with this. Some people will switch platforms, blah, 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 blah. And due to like a bunch of debacles and different things, people that all had 360s, for the most part, this is the key word, most part, went and bought PS4. So I was going to buy both anyway. I buy PS4. So I'm playing games with them. But some of those people, which I'd be normally playing games with regardless, have Xbox One because they didn't want to switch platforms. They wanted to stay with the Xbox. And that this has led me to actually purchasing some titles twice. Mm-hmm. I have two That's copies great. Of Battlefield 1. I have two copies of Call of Duty World War II. I have two copies of a few other games as well. Now, some of these things were bought like, you know, maybe a year later. And so, like, they were much cheaper or, like, whatever, right? It's not like I'm just going around spending full retail all the time. And a lot of these games I just refuse to buy on one platform or the other. Be like, no, I'm buying it on this platform. If you're not there, sorry. But most recently, and I believe it comes out this week, Call of Duty Modern Warfare. I'm actually probably going to play a lot with people on Xbox. Probably play with more so with people on PlayStation because they're more active. I am probably going to buy it on Xbox and not buy it on PlayStation. Because it's cross-platform. It doesn't matter.
Oh, so it's already happening.
Call of Duty Modern Warfare, the new one that is coming out, is cross-platform. Done.
Oh my God.
And it literally says it on the PlayStation blog website. Like, it literally says, plain as day, you can play with PC, Xbox One or PS4, and you can choose your control scheme. That's the main difference, just like Fortnite. You could choose if you want to play with everybody, or you want to play with just mouse and keyboard folk. Do you want to play with just your platform? Like, there's a bunch of different filters out there that allow you to choose what you want to play with. And so I'm literally probably going to purchase it, like I said, on Xbox One and play primarily with people on PS4 because it's just going to be easier because Xbox One has parties in the freaking mobile app. So one of the major issues was if I was going to play on PS4, the people that I play with on Xbox would want to join a party to talk rather than use the game chat. That's a bit of a pain in the ass. But it's not a pain in the ass when the people on PS4 have the Xbox app. They just use the Xbox app, they join our party, done. That's it. And so, it's going to be the first time ever, but I'm going to buy a game once instead of twice, because I would have bought that game twice, because it's Call of Duty's a big part of our gaming library. It's kind of our general, like, hey, you want to play COD? Let's go do it. So that is, like, that's a big thing. I have two Red Deads because it's not cross-platform.
Holy.
Two Red Deads. Now, admittedly, though, I just bought the other Red Dead, like, 2 months ago or something, and it was, like, $23. Like, it wasn't like I paid $90 and $90. And the other one was a Christmas gift. So, like, I paid, like, $23 for Red Dead. Let's calm down. But, regardless of which, it's still stupid for me to have two different characters, two different save files. It really, really helps. Even a person like me who has all the platforms, it helps bring everybody back together like they were in the 360 days when everyone was just on one platform. Now, what was the other question there? So what are your thoughts on cross-platform gaming on consoles? I think it's fantastic. There's a ding for question answer. Is there something in web development that isn't cross-use? One of the bigger things I've thought of, and I can't even think of like the exact thing, is I have used like really old web apps where it'll be like, oh, you like need to fill out this questionnaire for like applying for like a license or something like that. And it'll be like, this is, you know, we recommend Internet Explorer 11 for this because like that's where it's been tested kind of thing. We had a couple of instances like that in college. I don't remember if you remember where there was a couple of web apps we used for, some of our educational stuff, like answering quizzes and such. And it would tell you what platforms. Those are ones I could think up off the top of my head because schools and that aren't going to really upgrade if the student can just simply download that certain version of Internet Explorer or that certain version of Chrome, right? They're just going to leave it and be like, well, you know, there you go. So those are the ones that I can think of. With the rise of cloud computing, is the nature of these services being offered being forcing cross compatibility? I would say yes. And I've had extensive conversations with this on my other podcast. And what it is like we're going to a place where it's more service. So before you were pigeonholed by the hardware you purchased, an Xbox, like a physical Xbox, a physical PlayStation, a physical whatever it was, you were kind of like pigeonholed by that. And with this now, it's like I'll tell you a crazy thing we did this weekend. My one buddy played on an iPad. He booted up Fortnite. He connected a PlayStation 4 controller to the iPad. I was playing with him on my Switch. Like, how much cross-compatibility is that crap? Using PS4 hardware on an Apple piece of hardware to play the game, and then I was on Nintendo, which is usually the most locked down of all of them. I was on Nintendo, and we played just fine. No problem. And it was just like a regular match. Like, that, we won. Like, no big deal. Like, it was literally to that degree. And so, I would say that the service... I would say that things are going to more toward like the services, right? Like people like recurring revenue. They like the subscription model. Even Stadia has a subscription model or like, you know, would purchase individual games. I would say the subscription model, the service model does indeed help, in this sort of scheme. However, with that being said, I'm still skeptical that they'll ever give up their boxes. I know that wasn't an exact question. The boxes do give them certain things. Halo is one of them, for example. man, you know, people say Halo's on PC too. Yeah, okay, that's nice. You're probably playing it on Windows. So Xbox, Microsoft / Xbox has the advantage there. You know, there's no PlayStation OS for your computer. You know, there's no Sony OS for your computer. You're screwed in that regard. And so, like, Microsoft has the edge there. But people have argued with me saying everything's just going to become a service. But then I've asked, where are you going to play it? Oh, just my computer. Okay, you're going to convince everyone to buy a $2,000 or $3,000 computer, or even a cheap computer, and have it stream so it's not locally computed. Like, I don't think it's going to happen. I would say that we're going to see a big change, and that the services are bringing everyone together. But I still think there's going to be, you know, clear cut lines in the sand. I don't think you're going to see Drake, like Uncharted, the game Uncharted for the non gamers out there. I don't think you're going to see, you know, Uncharted on a fucking Xbox. I don't think you're going to see that for a long time. Now, there is stuff like Cuphead on Switch, so like maybe I'm completely wrong. But I would say that there will still be some sort of hardware wall. Like, I can't see a PlayStation 4 party connecting with an Xbox party, because PlayStation and Xbox, they don't want to deal with that crap. They're just because crossplay has always been technically possible. It's been logistically impossible. Xbox says we're not talking to the PlayStation guys. PlayStation says we're not talking to the Xbox guys. You know, whatever. Period. But now it's just like, hey, you game devs, since you guys have like server farms anyway, if you want to allow people to have, in most cases, their own friends list on your game and just have people connect to each other, go ahead. I'm not going to block the PlayStation anymore. I'm not going to block the Xbox or the PC anymore. And that's it. And with that also being said, there's some limitations. So the specialty things like the games, I said Halo and that, but even with Call of Duty, you can't play ranked. And you can't play a certain series, like the more esporty like stuff. You can't do
really?
That. Really? Yes, because it's like, which is better, a DualShock 4 or an Xbox controller? Which one? You know what I mean? So like that is a fair argument. Like, hey, he had a DualShock, or he had an Xbox controller, because there's money on the line in those cases, right? Not ranked, but like esports stuff is definitely. So.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, but. Another thing I want to throw at you is there's another, I don't know if you've heard of this, but Steam has released their own kind of, it's not really an answer, it's more of a feature in the mix. Steam Remote Play Together. Have you heard about that?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Okay, so what it allows you to do is it allows you to play local co-op games over the internet. Okay, so if you have a game like Overcooked, I don't know if you've ever played Overcooked,
yeah,
but you can do local co-op in that. Where you could play on one screen. I think there's Divinity 2, Original Sin, or whatever. I can't remember what it's called, but it's like an RPG game that also has a local co-op option. There's not a lot of new games that do, but a lot of older games that do. And the weird thing that I learned today is only one person has to buy the game.
That's like back to the DS days of like doing the Link play or whatever. Where only one person had a cartridge.
How it works, and I should have realized this when they announced it, is it's a stream. So the one person's playing the game, and then the other people are streaming it, and then sending their controls, obviously. Like, you can still use your controllers or your keyboard, whatever. But they're essentially just streaming it kind of in a la Google Stadia or PS Now kind of sense. So you're seeing the same screen, so it's just like local multiplayer. So it only requires one copy, which is interesting. And it also, like, this brings up the question, like, are larger gaming companies going to go for this if it limits the amount of copies that they're going to sell? Like, I mean, again, remote co-op, couch co-op is a dying thing.
Yeah.
Like, people don't go to each other's houses anymore. Like, you guys do still, but probably less than you did before.
And we usually play, like, a single-player game and, like, we just take turns, or a lot of the time we just end up in a YouTube hole. Like, it's like, yeah. Or we'll just watch movies. Like, it's not, I don't go and be like, yo, I'm coming over to play Xbox. Yeah, like, I haven't said that in fucking years.
Yeah, but it used to be a thing. It used to be a lot. Like, I mean, Halo, I remember doing that a lot. Gears of War, Borderlands, I did that. Like, Borderlands was another game that I could play local co-op. And then back in the day with Sega Genesis, like Streets of Rage and Sonic and like all these games, like I used to go to people's houses, or people used to come to my house and we'd sit down and, you know, play some games together on a couch, which was fun. Now that's going out, and there's not a lot of games that are really supporting it. So I don't know. Like, it's a weird thing that Steam decided to do. It's nice that you only have to buy one game, but like, what other games are going to support it? It's a confusing aspect.
I think what it is it's really going to be used, I would say, by the indie community. So like Gang Beasts is like an indie game that like got, you know, hit it big, you know, it's really popular and that type of thing. And like that's a couch. I don't know if you call it co-op, but that's like a couch playable game, a split screen, playable game where you're not actually playing split screen. You're just all in like the one screen. You're like fighting these weird animal things. But like, regardless of which, like that is an example of a game that would really benefit from like, hey guys, you want to play Gang Beasts? I've already bought it. Or like people will do the thing where like, especially if you're younger, you'll be like, yo, like, I have $20 and I don't know, Gang Beasts is $40. I don't know what the price is, but let's just say it's $40. You put $20 in, I put $20 in. We put it on your computer because I have faster internet and like, let's play Gang Beasts. You know, you could do that now. Whereas like before you couldn't, like each person would have to buy a copy. Hell, I was buying two copies for Christ's sake. Like, so like this is, I think this is like the cloud at work. Like, I think you're right in saying that it's not going to be the most popular feature. But I will say that it's something that I think that indie devs will use. And I think that indie devs are really the bread and butter of Steam, to be honest. Like, I think that that's where indie games go to get big or die. In my opinion, that's just my opinion. But to bring this back to like web development and your first initial comment where you're saying it just felt right. Like, it really does just feel normal. Like, what it is it's like, it's strange at first playing with multiple platforms, but then you're just like, this is awesome. Like, if you're to a person that's brand new, okay, to gaming in general, they're not really gonna see, like, they're not gonna, like, see, like, oh, what the hell do you mean you used to have to, like, not play on, like, PlayStation Network and Xbox Live? What the hell's going on here? Like, why couldn't they connect to each other, right? You're both on the internet, why can't you connect? But, like, to the person that's, like, used to having, like, the platforms be separated, this is, like, a huge step forward. But it feels so normal just moments in. Like, it was so normal playing with an Xbox that was using a PlayStation 4 controller and a Switch. Like, what a crazy concept. And crazy just due to the ingrained, like, business practices, right? And the reason why it feels normal is because of web development and that. Everyone can read everyone's blog. Everyone can, like, you know, use a calculator app online. People can use those online image converters. So, you know, it's not like, nope, sorry, bud, you know what I mean? Like, everyone can use, Twitch. A little bit of, like, obviously, if you have a super old computer, you can't. But as long as you're within some sort of modern standard, and I mean modern, like, even 10 years ago or more, you can stay relevant enough and you could play whatever. Like, you could have Windows 7 still. And you could watch Twitch, you could fuck around, like, no one's gonna kick you out, right? Until your platform becomes insecure or whatever. And that's it. Like, what a normal, and now everything's joining together. That's the main point, right? Like, that's the big thing.
Yep. Nope. So, I'm an optimistic person by nature. I did not think, I thought never would there be crossplay between PS4 and Xbox.
I agree. Yep.
I had absolutely, like, I didn't even think that that was an option. Like, I didn't even, like, you know, if someone would bring it up, I'd laugh it off, essentially.
Yeah, I'd agree.
So I'm happy. I'm very happy that it's going that way. And like you said, it is a very normal thing. Like, you just play with other people. Like, you just want to play with everyone all at the same time. Like, I don't care what system they have at all. And to bring it back to web development or even thin client computing, what I'm excited about is for the opportunity for everyone to have the same kind of playing field in terms of web development or in terms of computing power and stuff like that. Because a lot of the time, like, people can't afford, like, very powerful machines. People can't afford, in a web development sense, people can't afford to buy Macs all the time to test all their stuff because they're extremely expensive computers. It would be nice if they would offer a thin client. So, like, if you can go and maybe even run a subscription service. I don't know. Like, just have something where you can log into a Mac machine, connect up to it with be able to do USB debugging and everything. And, you know, use any computer just to do that. That would be great. I mean, again, it doesn't solve my problem of being able to take it with me and use it with any network connection, because I would assume you would need a pretty good network connection to be able to do that on a consistent basis, or be able to be efficient with it. But it is a step in the right direction, at least thin client computing in general. Again, I agree with you that it's not going to replace everything. Like Stadia is not going to go in and replace all the consoles, because it still requires a very good network connection. I think that's one of the major things with a thinner client, like with something that's just connected to a rendering powerhouse or whatever. It's just the world isn't ready for it yet.
Not widespread. It's a good step. No, not widespread.
No, exactly. Like we're very far away from being able to, like, you know, bring a really thin computer with us with only a battery essentially and a screen and a network card and be able to use that wherever we go. You know what I mean? Like if I were to do that, I would have to stick to very good. Like I would have to literally go and be like, what's the best coffee shop with the best internet all the time?
Yep.
Which is a pain. Like that's not something I want to have to worry about. Like I want to be able to not worry about having like the best internet connection in a hotel. You know what I mean? Like if I go to a hotel and it has a shitty internet connection, it's usually enough for me to work because all I really need it for is like syncing up to Git and searching a couple things on Google. Like I don't need a serious internet connection to do my web development. If I were to use a thin client, absolutely I would. Like there's just no other choice. So in my opinion, a great step, not something that's going to take over the industry quite yet. I think we're pretty far away from that unless, again, someone launches those satellites up into the air for that satellite Wi-Fi or satellite network that I think Bezos and Elon are both kind of trying to compete against. Like they both want to launch a bunch of satellites in the air and just have like a global network that you can access from anywhere.
I hadn't heard of that, so that's interesting.
That I think that would be the, if it's cheap enough and if it's fast enough. And if it goes
through clouds.
If it goes through cloud, like if everything that they're saying is true, that would be the driving factor. Like if you can legitimately go in the middle of the Sahara Desert
and just have like 5 bars or whatever,
and have 5 bars of like 5G,
even 4G is good enough for
what? True, yeah, true. Even 4G would be enough. But like, if let's say best case scenario of like 5G, then I think yeah, thin client computing is definitely the way to go.
Now, I will throw a wrench into that. I will say one thing: you are giving control to the people that are on the in the cloud for your computing. And what I say by that is like, okay, so we've seen some greasy stuff happen in the gaming industry, to bring it back to that, in the past with microtransactions and crap. Like there's a lot of like weird monetization stuff. Here's a strategy that could be used. Mike, you purchase Halo 1, the original one. It's out, hooray for your life. Now, the thing is that let's say you buy it on, this is all hypothetical people, let's calm down. Let's say you buy it on Stadia, because Stadia is cloud only, okay? So you buy it on Stadia and you stream it. There's no way to download it. You're not computing it locally. You're streaming it to your house. Okay. Now you've purchased it, one time purchase. You haven't paid, you know, you're not paying monthly or whatever. You're paying. So, but what you're doing is you are costing them monthly. Let's say you play the shit out of this game. You play it all the time. You play it online all the time, years. You're technically costing them a bunch of money. Eventually, and I don't know how long it would be, but eventually it's not going to be worth it for you to have that game. Okay. Like, technically speaking, like, they're now losing money. Like, before, it was like, you buy the game from them, you get it home, you use it, you're not using their infrastructure anymore, it's been an exchange. You want to use this on your computer, on your electricity bill? Here you go, right? Here's your disk, or here's your download. That's how it used to work. Now, it's their electricity bill, some of yours, but their electricity bill, their computing power, and their internet, which then connects to your internet, of course, and that type of thing, but you're not computing it locally. So here's a greasy thing that could, again, this is all hypothetical, happen. They find out a bunch of people are playing the first Halo. What do they do? Sorry, the original Halo is no longer available on Google Stadia. 2 years later, please purchase the Halo Remastered Edition for the same price as you purchased the original Halo for. They could logistically do that.
To be fair, that it kind of, I don't know if it solidifies your point or goes against your point. This, I don't know. Stuff like that constantly happens right now with physical copies of games. And in terms of servers.
Oh, yeah.
You bring Halo 1 up, the Halo 1 servers on Xbox.
Are done, though, yeah.
You can have a million Halo 1 discs. They're physical. Hooray. Hooray for your life. You cannot play online on Xbox with Halo 1, unless you get the Master Chief Collection, etc. This is an example. There's plenty of games like this. Call of Duty Modern Warfare, the first one, number 4, can't play that.
No, unless you buy the remaster, I think.
Correct. Like you're saying, like you're literally describing the situation that's already happening on a consistent basis.
But the thing is, though, is like the server situation is one thing, because the server situation also happens to go up. Like servers generally, I didn't know the Modern Warfare, the original ones, were offline. I didn't know that.
Yes.
No. But anyway.
World at War is offline. Modern Warfare 4 is offline, I believe. Yeah.
But regardless of which, so it's like when you're. Like, when you have the ability to go online with a game like that, generally speaking, and like, you check this before you purchase it, when you purchase it, like, you know there's a campaign at least. They can't technically ever take that campaign away from you, and you could play that campaign. Now, I understand you might be like, well, it's only 5 hours, so it's boring or whatever, but yeah. You might, for nostalgia's sake, years later, want to go do that. You want to do that in that hypothetical I said, you want to go through the Halo 1 campaign, $80, please.
No, yeah, I understand there are some, like Witcher 3, for example, doesn't have any online services. People play it for hundreds of hours.
Yeah.
They could do that.
Like, why wouldn't you do that? That
they could do. Well, they wouldn't do that because of the negative backlash and et cetera, et cetera. That would be the only reason. And if this is literally a calculation, I'm not being anti-corporate or whatever. There is a calculation that they have that does the outrage equal or is less than or equal to the amount of money that we're going to make for doing this kind of situation. And they have a formula, like all these companies
that do,
EA and all those guys, they have a formula. Blizzard, with their response to the whole Hong Kong thing, they had a formula. They're like, how much are we going to make in this situation? Is it worth the backlash? They decided it was. Whether they're right or wrong, it's not for us to decide.
I'm not getting into the morality of it, but you are correct. Yeah, like there's a value algorithm. They have.
So they're going to do that value algorithm, and hopefully the outrage is more than the money they're going to make. That's the only hope we have in that situation. It's not like we can stop this from happening at this point. We can only hope.
Wait, you want the outrage again, to be more than the money they make?
No, I want the outrage in their formula to be more than the money they would make if they were to do
you,
that situation.
Oh, you want that. I thought you meant, yes, I thought they meant they, okay, they want that. I was like, what the hell?
No, screw them.
But like, I get it. Like, it's weird. Cause I was thinking about this the other day. It's like, right now, like, obviously, like, disc could be lost and that type of thing. But like, if you want to play GTA 4 in its original state, you can't do that on anything but, and like, an offline copy. Because they changed, like, the radio stations. And you might be just like, well, it's just the radio stations. Yeah, but like, okay, like, the Super Mario theme, like, you know, like, for all you Mario fans out there, Super Mario theme, like, comes, you know, it lapses. That specific version on your game lapses. So what are they going to do? Like, put, like, Gangster's Paradise, like the Sonic movie, in the background? Like, you know what I mean? Like, seriously, though. Like, come on, man. Like, what the hell's going on here? Like, we're changing single-player things. And they'll do that on frickin' Stadia, like, when it comes by, because the music rights. Like, they don't have a choice.
I mean, that happens pretty rare, but you're right. It does happen.
It sounds rare, but it's also... We're talking about under 20 years of constant connectivity for consoles. Like, PS2 and that had connectivity, yes, and everything. But, like, games, you know, 10 years ago, you would never think of, I'm only going to buy this game for multiplayer. There were very few examples of that. Like, I bought Mag years ago on PS3. That was that big multiplayer game. That thing's dead. I can't use that disc anymore. I could probably, maybe I could load the menu or something. But, like, I don't know. But yeah, I don't know if that's all you had to add there, Mike, but I can run the old conclusion if you like.
Run her
Alrighty, up. Well, thank you for listening, and make sure you don't miss an episode by subscribing on the platform of your choice. You can follow us on the socials via @HTMLAllTheThings. That is on Facebook and Instagram. You can also follow us on Twitter. That's @HTMLEverything. We are on Medium, and we're on GitHub. And remember, we're also on Patreon. That's patreon.com/HTMLAllTheThings. Check out the tiers and give that a go. And many thanks to our $3 tier patrons, Sean from RabbitWorks JavaScript. You can find him at youtube.com/RabbitWorksJavaScript. Garrick from Local Path Computing and Web Design. You can find him at localpathcomputing.com. Craig, a.k.a. Cosworth. Ryan Gatchell from Blue Black Digital. Find him at blueblackdigital.com. Chris from Self-Made Web Designer. Find him at selfmadewebdesigner.com. And Tim from The Web Hacker. You can find him at thewebhacker.com. Feel free to leave a comment or a review on the platform that you are listening to this on. And we are signing off.